Welcome to Vital Connections On Air, a podcast brought to you by University of Minnesota Extension's Center for Community Vitality that explores the trends and topics important to communities and leaders throughout Minnesota. My name is Christy Kalavig, and I'm an educator with University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality. Today, I am excited to bring you episode 2 in our 2-part workforce series wrap-up. Do you remember when Laura Kalambakidis, Minnesota State Economist and Extension Economist, said this about exploring Minnesota's workforce issues?
Makes me excited to see what 10 years from now will look like. And where hopefully what we've done is we've created more flexible jobs, and we've got people living in different places than they might have otherwise, and we've got people who might not have been in the workforce or are fully engaged in the workforce. Mm-hmm. And those, we've created those pathways and those connections between employers and organizations and the government and the community, and we've built those, and that stays part of our economic assets for the state of Minnesota. Imagine if Minnesota is the state that thrives in this interesting, new, diverse environment. It'll be an exciting place to study and work in.
This thought inspired us at the Center for Community Vitality. We had been exploring the topic of workforce for well over a year when I met with Laura, and she shared this in her podcast. But after a few more of us heard her dream, it ignited a conversation that we then took to the entire University of Minnesota and invited a large group of researchers to come together to talk about workforce, to think about what we can do better to understand the issue and how we can create change. Those in the room were given the responsibility to think like a scholar but care like a concerned citizen by Kent Olson, the Dean of the Center for Community Vitality. Out of this day, relationships were developed, new research ideas were explored, and connections into communities were created. The previous episode, as well as this one, are wrap-ups from the symposium. Today, you will hear about specific workforce-related issues such as childcare shortages, transportation challenges, housing availability, and healthcare through the lens of people who are working closely with these topics. We hope that this sampling will make you curious to learn more and have made the slides and all of the audio from the day available at z.umn.edu/workforce-symposium. Throughout today's episode, you will also hear some flashbacks to insights that were shared by previous podcast guests who joined us throughout this workforce series. Scott Formo Sr., Mayor of Glenwood, Minnesota, and Executive Director of the Chamber of Commerce there, joined us for episode 11 of the podcast. During that episode, he shares that he regularly hears concerns from new residents about housing in this small rural community, and this led them to conducting a housing study to find out more about the needs of their residents.
But some of the things we were hearing from people who were new to the area was that they were having a hard time finding both rental housing or homes to live in, saying that, they're coming here to try to find a new job, but either the homes that they were looking to buy needed a lot more work than what they wanted to put into it, or they were too expensive for them to be able to afford as a starter home and just starting new jobs in the area.
Ann Zebarth, rural sociologist and professor of housing studies at the University of Minnesota, discussed her concerns about workforce housing in Minnesota.
I'm Ann Zebarth. I just want to say that I'm a sociologist by trade, and I've spent my career studying rural places, small towns, and in particular I look at housing as an indicator of those demographic changes, economic changes, and social and political changes as well. So what is workforce housing? Let's begin with that. Workforce housing basically is often housing for workers, right? Workers and their families. So it could be anybody who is employed or wants to be employed and where they live. So we're talking about predominantly in terms of community struggle with workforce housing. It's housing that is affordable, available for new employees, often at starting wages. And so oftentimes the sort of metric that communities use is families with incomes between 60 and 120% of the area's median income. How do you know if you have that kind of housing? Well, everybody do this. We're going to talk about 5 A's for housing. First, you have to have housing stock that's available, right? It has to be there. You have to have ownership and rental opportunities that are available when people want to move into your town. Secondly, it has to be adequate. Those buildings, those structures have to be in good shape. The mechanical systems have to work. You know, the basic structural aspects of housing as a building. Third, it has to be affordable. It has to, the cost of that housing has to match the incomes of the workers that are in your particular community. It has to be appropriate. It has to meet the needs of the workers and their families in that place, okay? So that means that it has to be the right size for the kinds of people who are coming to your community. So if you're attracting new immigrants, if those immigrants tend to have larger family sizes, and you have one and two bedroom kind of housing available, it may not be appropriate for the families that you want. And finally, that housing, number five, needs to have certain accessible amenities, jobs, schools, healthcare, all those things that communities offer. Why care about workforce housing? Well, housing is an asset, both for the families and for the communities. And as an asset, it creates the everyday lives, health, and well-being of the people who live in it. And it's a key for attracting and retaining workers. People won't stay if they have to commute too far. There's no place for them to live. It's a problem. Talk to the folks in Rosa. They'll tell you how difficult it is to recruit qualified workers in a community that doesn't have enough housing. It also affects the multiplier effect of economic development activities. Communities invest in economic development. They assume that they will not only get the return in terms of jobs, but also those other things, those other benefits to the community, that it will affect their main street businesses, that the schools will have more students, that these jobs will also contribute to the development of the community as a whole. And that's the multiplier effect. Is anyone here from Olivia? Mm-hmm. Olivia, Minnesota? They had an economic development director who figured out at one point, a number of years ago, that attracting jobs wasn't enough. They had a new plant opening up. They had new people moving, or anticipating new people moving into town. They didn't have housing available for those newcomers. They had senior housing. They had, you know, a few rundown trailer homes, but that wasn't going to attract people to their community. And they figured out those folks were going to move someplace else if they didn't provide housing. Now, in the end, they did. They were able to develop some nice middle class sort of rental housing. It gave people a place to move into town, and then hopefully those people would buy homes and settle and stay as well, freeing up that rental housing for more newcomers to come into the town. It wasn't a smooth trip, and if anybody wants to talk to me about how that happened, I'd be happy to talk about it. It took them a long time, and that's one of the problems. Affordability is key, and it's only the income or the wages or the cost of the housing have to be balanced. And so we're always looking at that sort of match between housing costs and balance. Here in Minnesota, the National Low Income Housing Coalition publishes information about rental costs and the housing wage, what it costs, how much you need to earn to afford a two-bedroom home in Minnesota statewide is about $18.60 an hour, or a monthly wage of $611. There's no place in the state where anyone with a minimum wage can afford to live in a decent two-bedroom home. And we also have to be careful about affordability in terms of rules of thumb. We use a magic number. We use a 30% of household income for housing costs. And if people are paying more than that, it's considered housing cost burdened. That 30%, however, can be misleading. If it's on the very low end of the income, 30% may not leave you enough to pay for the rest of your housing expenses, healthcare, food, insurance, everything else, transportation, everything else you need. Also, high wages don't necessarily mean that you have affordable, available housing. Think North Dakota oil boom. They have very high, and so one of the big barriers is the lag in time in housing that occurs between what it takes to develop housing and when the jobs arrive. So there's always a lag in that, and that's one of the challenges that communities have, to anticipate the future. Housing is not fixed, it's grounded in place, and that's key. Community leaders and community community ordinances, laws, land use planning, land use regulation, all impact housing. Two of our community extension educators, and probably more, are working on a project to compile case studies of local solutions to housing problems. And Ryan, can you wait? Ryan and Merritt are taking some leadership on this, and they've done a number of examples of case studies here in Minnesota. Claremont, Minnesota is a town of about 550 population, and it's a problem. But it's using a team approach to solve the problem. My time's up here, and I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. One is workforce housing is embedded in the community. For most people, as Ryan was talking about, we worry about policies based on our own perceptions, on our own experiences. Most people live somewhere, and the leadership in most communities are living comfortably, and so housing is not necessarily a salient issue. There's some very interesting work going on about public perception and public opinions and leadership responsibility with regard to addressing this housing problem.
Housing helps more than a town's economy. Ensuring that there is adequate housing available to those who want to live there is crucial to creating a vibrant community, as Ryan Pesch noted during our conversation in episode 11 on Glenwood's housing study.
Well, I think when it comes to workforce housing, the major issue is you might have somebody that's commuting in for a job, but ideally you want to be able to retain that person and make them kind of a full citizen of the place, right? So if somebody's commuting into Glenwood, they might be doing a little bit of shopping in town and so forth. That has an economic impact. It's quite a bit different when somebody makes Glenwood their home as opposed to a place where they just work. Not only do you have that economic impact as dollars and cents calculation about people spending, and I would assume that would certainly go up, but you also have them as more a bigger contributing member of everything from local service clubs to getting involved in school and bringing their own kids to the school. All of these things have an overall impact on kind of the vitality of the community, without a doubt.
Much like housing connects people to their job and the community, the availability of transportation is critical to helping people access the jobs they want or need while living in a community that they feel connected to. Yingling Fan, associate professor at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, joined the symposium to share insights on transportation challenges that she has discovered within her research.
I also wanted to talk about transportation, right? Because when you have a spatial mismatch between jobs and where people live, it's important that you create the transportation connections. And when it comes to unemployed people, they are more transit dependent than other population groups. So it's important that we provide a public transportation service to the unemployed. There are area advantages. And also it's very important, it points to potential solutions. Residential segregation and the geographic disparity are part of the problem that has led to spatial mismatch. They also point to the particular importance of spatially targeted and localized strategies for eliminating disparities. So important that we take advantage of those area advantages. and pay attention to localized opportunities. The best prospects will be efforts that target the specific communities and focus on sweet spot jobs that are transit accessible. It's important that when you do workforce training, you understand the area advantage, and you make sure that people actually have transportation to get to those job opportunities. Look at the entire pipeline, job seekers' skills and the interests, available training, and job reachable by transit and interested employers. Because employers have a problem too, they need to retain, you know, have access to workforce as well. Reach out to employers who might partner, same idea. Provide a frequent and rapid regional service as a transit backbone, plus a small vehicle local service near workforce. Transportation issue, right, very important when it comes to workforce issue. Pursue job transit-oriented economic development in the long run. It's important that we have jobs, more jobs transit accessible in this region. And finally, understand the existing skill sets in disadvantaged areas, geospatial data on skills and community strengths.
Laura Connell-Bakitis discussed the innovative ways that employers are looking at both housing and transportation issues that were discussed by Ann Zeebarth and Yingling Fan when she joined us for episode 6 of the podcast, Minnesota's Workforce.
I think we have, you know, I think other people have seen this, but I think it's a fascinating trend, is large employers looking for pockets of workers in other parts of the metro area or other parts of the state, and figuring out their own solutions to transportation and housing. I've heard of employers up north investing in multifamily housing in order to make that available for workers to come up and live. And we know of employers in the Twin Cities, in the suburban areas, that are busing folks from the city out to where the jobs are.
Our workforce challenges are impacting industries differently. For sectors such as healthcare, it is one more thing that is impacting their ability to be financially successful, as well as how they work to serve those that are in need of their services.
You know, in that Minnesota is a healthcare state, we have a lot of people working in the healthcare industry. That is a sector that is important to the state, and it is facing challenges. And I talked about geographically that in less densely populated parts of the state, this is getting to be a critical issue, is finding those workers. One of the big challenges there is that wages can't necessarily go up in those sectors because so much of those services are being paid for by the government. And so there's restriction in how much reimbursement, how much can be paid for Medicaid services and Medicare services. And so there's this block, you know, or this tension where people, if there were a market, then the wage would probably go up, but the wage can't go up, and so then you might have a sustained shortage.
Dr. Jennifer Schultz, co-director of the Healthcare Management Program and professor of economics at the Labovitz School of Business and Economics on the University of Minnesota Duluth campus, brought insights from her 25 years of research on healthcare reform and experience as a member of the Minnesota House of Representatives to the symposium.
Well, we've been talking about healthcare workforce shortages for a long time, my entire career. So it's not something that's new. And I 20 years ago when I... not 20 years, but 15 years ago when I started at UMD, a clinic in northeast Minnesota, a rural clinic, contacted me and my colleague Joe Klingner and wanted us to do a survey for them of why individuals were leaving their community and going to a larger healthcare clinic hospital system in Duluth. They wanted us to do a phone survey, collect information, and we went up there, visited with the board members and some of their physicians, and we said, you don't need to spend any money on that survey, because we can tell you why they're doing that, because of the great research that was already been conducted. And why do you think people were leaving that small community and going to a larger community for their healthcare needs? Any
more
guesses?
Choices. More choices on doctors.
Probably more specialists, but that wasn't the number. There are two big reasons.
Perception of quality. Perception of privacy.
And privacy. Those are the number two reasons. So we didn't have to do that. So they had to overcome the perception that they were lower quality providers, so they had to advertise more about their great qualified positions they did have on staff, and they had to talk about why their information was private. So that's what they had to overcome. Today, what they have to overcome is a lot different of why they're struggling in rural communities to provide healthcare. And one of the reasons, one thing they're struggling with is the level of consolidation in healthcare systems. So we see this more and more. Now, the metro area has been integrated vertically and horizontally for a long time compared to other states. We're gonna see in the next 10 years, probably a 50% reduction in independent hospitals or hospitals that are associated with one system getting larger. So this is putting pressure on rural communities, healthcare, because providers are merging and acquiring other clinics and hospital systems are coming together, so they have more bargaining power with insurance plans providers. Because there was consolidation on the insurance side, they gained more negotiating power at the table, and now providers are needing more negotiating power so they can get reimbursement levels at a higher level. This hurts independent hospitals and clinics, which are predominantly in rural areas, because now they have less negotiating power and they get lower reimbursement rates for their services. It makes it much more difficult for them to cover their costs and hire, because they usually have to pay more to get healthcare individuals to work in their community. So it's putting more pressure on them financially to be able to attract good quality physicians and other providers in their community. There are some benefits to some of that consolidation, and you may see some health systems going out into rural areas or small towns to buy clinics because they can benefit from electronic health records, which are very expensive. They can benefit from hopefully possibly lower cost and economies of scale, but also just the amount of overhead would be reduced, and working with other experts and specialists from that system to provide better care so you could see better outcomes. And it may prevent a small hospital from closing if they integrate with a larger system. So in Minnesota, we have about 129 hospitals. 77 of those hospitals are called critical access hospitals. We have the third highest in the nation of critical access hospitals. We have 16 federally qualified health centers that are serving, I believe, 77 sites for those critical access, federally qualified health centers. And we have a lot of rural areas. So we have to figure out how can we make sure those healthcare clinics and hospitals survive? Because what happens when a rural hospital closes, it's very devastating for a community. There's been a lot of research done in Texas, but it increases drive times. You saw some researchers at the University of Minnesota look at obstetric care and how we don't have a lot of obstetric care in rural Minnesota, and that affects outcomes for the mother and for the baby. It may lead to a lot of job losses. Sometimes the hospital is the largest employer in the community, so it could be very devastating and could lead to really a disruption of that community. So we have a lot of shortages. We have mental health counselors. Now with the opioid crisis, we don't have enough mental health providers in rural Minnesota, so six times as many individuals per one mental health counselor in rural Minnesota. So much higher in the, much more availability in urban area. And this trend is true for dentists. We have problems attracting dentists. Even into Duluth, which is not rural, we have a hard time attracting dental providers and dental specialists. So it's about three times as many. Physicians, about two times primary care physicians and RUCs. So we have to look at how we can attract providers and what we can do to attract providers. So I have 1 minute left. So these are the solutions. I serve on two healthcare workforce commissions and committees at the legislature. So we learn a lot about what we're trying to do in terms of policy. One is loan forgiveness. We've been defunding. We've not been funding adequate loan forgiveness programs to get people to work. We have been trying to license more individuals, mid-level and lower level, to work at the top of their license to practice. Does anyone know what AHEC is? Mm-hmm. Area Health Education Centers. Northeast Minnesota had the very first one. I don't think it's even around. I used to be on their board. We've really underfunded those AHECs federally and at the state level. They are critical to educating individuals, very young individuals, all the way from kindergarten through high school, about healthcare careers, because you need to go recruit individuals who live in the rural community and want to get educated in healthcare professions, and then they'll go back. So we really haven't done a good job in funding AHEPs. But new things on the horizon is telemedicine. We're going to be able to use telemedicine and technology to help those rural communities with healthcare, providing better healthcare. The other thing that we need to do as a state is increase Medicaid reimbursement rates. People in rural communities tend to be lower income. They have more individuals on medical assistance and Medicare, which tends to pay less. Another good thing you could look at is what Northeast Minnesota did was a lot of the independent hospitals, they created their own loose network called Wilderness Health. And they help each other survive where they don't feel more pressure to join the larger healthcare system. They're working with each other more and improving quality, reducing costs, and using technology.
Another industry hit hard by the shortage of workers is childcare. Over the course of 3 podcasts, we discuss the challenges that this sector is experiencing. Marty Werner, Director of Research for the Center for Rural Policy Development, shared the specific workforce challenges that daycare centers in rural Minnesota face when she joined us for Episode 9, The Childcare Challenge for Minnesota's Workforce.
Especially in rural areas, it's very hard to find staff, partly because of the educational requirements that are required. Also just because of the workforce shortage these days in rural areas, it's very difficult to staff a daycare center and to staff it consistently, to find people, you know, who can stay around. And so that's a big problem with daycare centers in rural areas too.
Elizabeth Davis, professor with the Department of Applied Economics, shared with those attending the symposium what we know and what we need to know in order to invest wisely to support families, children, employers, and communities when dealing with the childcare crisis.
Thank you, and good morning. I'm Liz Davis. I'm from the Department of Applied Economics over on the St. Paul campus. And I'm going to talk to you about who cares about childcare. Suddenly, everybody cares about childcare. It's in the news. Legislators, economic developers, community leaders, employers, they've all discovered childcare. Now, parents of young children and those working in the field have always known that childcare can be hard to find, and it's usually expensive relative to your budget, and for the most part, parents need it in order to work. So why has this become such an issue now? Is the problem worse in some way? And if so, why? So what's changed to make this a crisis at this point? So first, terminology. I'm going to refer to mostly childcare. Sometimes it's called daycare. But it's also important to think about it as childcare and early education. You really can't separate care that an adult needs to be with a child under age 5 and education, because every experience of a young child affects their brain development, for better or for worse. And we know that the gaps in skills and preparedness start really young in children and grow, the disparities by income groups grow over time between birth and kindergarten entry. So we really need to be thinking about broadly about childcare and early education as a combined experience for children. Okay, so why is it an issue now? Well, we really have a perfect storm. We have low unemployment rates combined with high labor force participation rates for women in Minnesota. In 2014, 3/4 of Minnesota households with children under age 6 had all parents in the workforce. And that's the third highest in the nation. We have had declining numbers of childcare providers in Minnesota, especially licensed family child care providers. These are women, usually women, who provide care for other people's children in their home and in the provider's home. And at the same time, we have a growing recognition of the importance of early childhood development for later child outcomes, as well as for supporting the current workforce and for development of the human capital of the future workforce. Okay, so the headlines are all about the shortages. Shortage of child care, Senate bill meant to ease the child care shortages. 26% of Minnesotans live in a child care desert. That sounds pretty bad. We want to live in a desert. But the focus here is really all on supply. So what's the facts? Well, yes, we have seen a large decline in the number of licensed family childcare providers in Minnesota, almost 30% decline over the decade 2005 to 2015. So one thing to notice is this has been going on for a while, this decline. Okay, it's not just the past couple years with new regulations, it's been a pretty steady decline. It has been somewhat offset in some places by increases in the number of childcare centers. Okay, so that's outside of someone's home, a separate building, or sometimes in a church or school. That's primarily happening in the Twin Cities area and in larger towns and small cities. So the capacity, that is the number of children who can be served in licensed childcare, has been declining statewide about 5% over that decade. But the declines and the shortages really are very localized. These trends differ in different places, and so in some places this is a much bigger issue than in others. But there's some things that aren't new about this crisis. So it's not new that childcare is expensive relative to the budgets of young families. Okay, families with young children usually are at the beginning of their careers, they're at the lower end of their earnings trajectories, and on average, low-income families who pay for childcare spend about 20% of their income on childcare, compared to about 6% for higher-income families. At the same time, those who work in this field, the childcare teachers and childcare providers, tend to be low-paid, compared to people with similar education levels. So the median hourly wage, this is nationally for childcare teachers with a bachelor's degree, is less than $15 an hour. And finally, what's not new is that we know that high-quality childcare and early education can break the link between family income and disparities in school readiness, as well as supporting the current workforce. Okay, so I want to talk about three things that I think are missing from this current debate or current focus on the shortage and the crisis in childcare. Okay, it's not all about the supply. Some of what's happening is changing parent preferences about the type of childcare they use. Parents seem to be preferring to put their children more often in center-based care than in licensed family homes. So this decline in the family childcare providers is happening across the nation, and in fact, in some states, it's much higher, a much more rapid decline than in Minnesota. We need to be thinking about affordability. So for families, unlike K through 12 education, the majority of funding for early care and education, who's paying for it, is parents. Okay, in K through 12, it's the public sector that's paying for most of it. So the lack of supply to some extent reflects a lack of demand because parents can't afford it. And we also need to be thinking about quality. Quality really matters for child outcomes and for families choosing where they're going to put their kids. The providers of childcare and early education need stable funding in order to make and sustain quality improvements. So saying that childcare is too expensive, unaffordable, doesn't mean that lower prices is the solution. We need a deeper understanding of how parents can afford is driving both supply and quality in the market. So I want to tell you briefly, there are some innovative things going on around Minnesota in terms of childcare and early education. There have been a number of communities trying to come up with community-based solutions to the shortage problem. So some examples are places in which they're figuring out how to host three or four family childcare providers, not in their homes, but together in a county building. There are organizations like First Children's Finance that provide business training and loans to help make providers be more sustainable and have better business practices. And employers are engaging in public-private partnerships to help try to solve the shortage problem. But I think we need to think beyond the supply issues and consider ways in which we can tackle the affordability and the quality issues as well. So some ideas might be to increase the payment rates in the child care assistance program, or to increase funding for that program and for early learning scholarships, and to create incentives and support for providers who are providing quality care. So we do need research. I mean, I'm an academic, we always need research. Some of the research that Erin Sojourner, who's in the room, and I are working on is looking at improved measures of access, so moving beyond the supply, to identify areas which have low access based not just on supply, but on affordability, cost, and quality, and looking at it from a family-centered spatial point of view rather than that based on particular areas. So we also need to know more about market responses to the policy and funding changes. There have been a lot of those in Minnesota over the last few years, but we need to know how that's affecting both providers and families. The expanded role for employers, there's not been much research on that. And finally, if we're able to demonstrate the links between quality investments and outcomes, we'll know more about how better to invest public dollars.
As Elizabeth Davis pointed out, there are questions to explore and things to discuss as we work to better understand childcare in Minnesota. Laura Kalamakidis also shared that she believes that we must continue to discuss this challenge and work towards solutions in order to get everyone into the workforce, as well as to prepare our future workforce.
This is one of the critically important issues in trying to get everybody into the game, because you know, people make rational decisions. I'm an economist. I tend to think people make mostly rational decisions. Of course, we know that's not always the case. But when I think about someone deciding what job to take or how much to work, and they've got a family, they've got kids at home, so you sit down at the kitchen table and you figure it out. Like, I can take this job making this much money per hour, and I'm gonna have to pay this much per hour for childcare and transportation and extra food costs because I'm not gonna be making dinner at home. So you know, couples do this, families do this. They figure it out, and if childcare costs more than what they can make, it's going to be a no-brainer, and they're going to say, you know what, I'm going to continue to take care of my kids at home and wait this out. And why would childcare cost so much? Well, it's going to cost a lot in places where it's scarce. And you know, maybe there is childcare, and maybe it's not that expensive, but it's 20 miles in one direction, and the job I want is 20 miles in the other direction. And when you add up the transportation costs, it's not worth it. So having a greater supply of childcare options and more flexibility in terms of work options can draw more people into the workforce. Another aspect of childcare is that we know that early childhood education, investment in high quality early childhood education, is an investment in that future workforce we need.
The topics shared during the symposium and the discussions that we had during our podcast were just the tip of a very large iceberg. There are more conversations to be had and more questions to ask. But let's start by doing what Ken Bartlett, Professor for Human Resource Development Program with the College of Education and Human Development, urged us to do when he spoke at the symposium.
And I encourage us to change the way we look at things, because when we do that, the things we look at tend to change.
As we change the way we look at things, let's make sure that we remember to continue looking at Minnesota's economy and workforce as an asset, just as Laura Kalamakidis described it during her podcast visits.
One of the state's greatest economic assets is the diverse economic base. Another of our great assets is our strong workforce. We have a well-educated workforce and very high labor force participation. So that's another asset for us.
As we close out this series exploring Minnesota's workforce, what are your thoughts? What questions do you have that you think we should be considering? Share those ideas and join the conversation by commenting on the podcast, leaving a message on our Facebook page, or sending us a tweet. Remember that you can see all of the presentations from the symposium, including slides and the full audio, at z.umn.edu/workforcesymposium. Learn more about the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality at extension.umn.edu/community-development. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date on new research and resources for communities and those who lead them. Please join us again for another episode of Vital Connections on Air.